episode 52 of season 16. Hello, I'm your host, Lyle Troxell, and today I've got a collaboration of a few different people. First, myself. Hi. A couple weeks ago, Ben, Miles, and I, on an episode, were chatting about software engineers versus developers versus programmers, and we went off on it a bit. Clearly, not understanding the full extent of what other people would feel, we got some feedback. From Joel, I'm currently a senior software engineer, formerly a programmer analyst, for a medium-sized insurance company, so I feel confident to have an opinion on the topic of titles. First, I agree that many terms are commonly interchangeable, and that it would be better if they were actually meaningful, but I have to disagree that engineer should be a term referring to someone with a degree from higher education. My straw man, Alice, is trained as a theoretician, but ends up working 20 years implementing software, learning and applying processed to the of the industry. Bob studied software engineering processes and went on to get a doctorate in them and taught engineering for 20 years. Who is the engineer? Surely the one who practiced engineering, not the one who studied it. And Joel goes on. Here is my personal view on how these various terms should be used. Programmer, anyone who is aware that they are instructing computer systems in relatively predictable ways, whether they write Java, assembler, Excel macros, or a domain-specific language, HTML, CSS, some XML. I consider them all to be programmers. I realize this is not widely accepted. Coder, a new word for programmer. Fine. Programmer analyst, a job title for a programmer who can do systemic thinking about the software and its place in the environment around it. Software engineer, a programmer who follows some relatively standard processes to try achieving more reliable results. Developer, a programmer who is being paid by someone else to create, change software according to their requirements. And computer scientist, a programmer who uses actual computers only incidentally as the way to develop their abstract or theoretic ideas. Joel says, love the show. Thanks, Joel. So the feedback about computer scientists, the one thing I'd argue, I agree with most of what you're saying, the computer scientist is definitely someone who thinks about programming and computers in general, how computers work and how they operate in a scientific methodology. So that is research around the science of computers. And that is a large field of mathematics and conceptual concepts, definitely strong in academia, scientists. However, we also got some great feedback from Alex, and Alex was kind enough to record his response to us and our conversation.
You guys are totally killing me on the engineering term and the different engineering degrees. So let me chime in on that. So first, I am a computer engineer. I have a Bachelor of Science in Computer Engineering from the Electrical and Computer Engineering School at UCSD. Based on my own understanding of the different engineering programs that I looked into when I was looking at going, as well as other conversations I've had with other people who have similar degrees to what I have, most of the computer engineering and related programs seem to follow somewhat of a consistent structure, you know, more or less. Computer science degrees, they tend to focus heavily on software. Computer engineers take almost all the same classes as a CS major, minus a handful of advanced classes like advanced operating systems or advanced compiler design. But then you add in a bunch of electrical engineering classes, the hardware stuff. So we have to do circuit design and things like that. So that's computer engineering. And then electrical engineers, they're the hardware guys. They're the ones who are designing the silicon, the chips and entirely focused on hardware. Obviously there's software within hardware, but you know where that line kind of lies. So software engineer is a degree in some places. I haven't seen it that often, but where I have seen it, it tends to end up focusing a bit more on the practical uses of software integration and design, as opposed to the computer science that tends to focus a bit more on the actual science of computers. So you get a lot more into algorithms and that sort of thing. I mean, again, obviously lots of overlap, lots of range in that. But when I see the software engineer separate from computer science, that's kind of what I've seen as the distinction with that. So my personal view is I think the term engineer is one that is worth preserving. in terms of actually meaning something. As has been noted, many are self-taught in the industry. Most will never have a deeper understanding of the surrounding technology that those who have the degree are required to learn. So programmers may not always, they'll understand how to code, but they won't understand some of the technologies around it or why certain things are certain ways. It's that sort of deeper understanding that I think is the added value of having somebody who has the engineering degree itself. And that's not to say, computer science either. That's just more simply the representation of the degree. But engineering also, I think, has that value. For those that are hiring, I think it's important. I believe that it's been recently emphasized that technical interviews are ineffective in determining one's ability to actually do well in the job. I don't know if I completely agree with that, but that's something that has been discussed. I don't know if you're on the show necessarily, but has been discussed in general in websites and articles I've seen online. So experience can be used, but also education. I'll always weigh an educated engineer over another candidate who has this same basic experience. With the lack of personal experience with that person, that's what we have to go on. So the same holds for more formal engineering credentials. The reason we require engineers to be certified and credentialed historically and commonly is that they're often in positions where they're designing and building something that has impact on human life or other hugely detrimental repercussions if something went wrong with what they built or what they designed. So the certifications and education provide a better assurance with all other perceived differences being equal. And one might argue that software and computer engineers should be required to have a real emphasis on security and safety in building of the technical systems that they build as part of their education, especially these days. The problems that are now showing themselves due to poorly engineered, security-wise, systems is widespread, and it's ranging from significant loss of privacy to financial damages to even loss of life in the case of military data systems being hacked and such like that. And now with healthcare systems being so quickly connected to networks, loss of life in the citizen realm is just around the corner. I don't think I've heard any stories about that. So anyway, just wanted to chime in on my views of engineering and that term and where I think it has a place. Hope you like the feedback.
Thanks, Alex. Yes, of course, we appreciate your feedback. And I also appreciate Joel's feedback and other people that emailed as well. One thing, of course, Alex talked about was technical interviews. And, there's a lot of I've cited quite a few times this Google study about the process of interviewing and whether technical interview is actually effective. And I'm pretty strong opponent to relying on technical interviews to determine hiring capabilities or hiring a technical person. I agree that a degree denotes an important aspect of a person. And of course, an applicable degree in the field of computers, any of the degrees that Alex mentioned would be applicable. My degree, of course, is in electrical technologies, and it completely helps me understand how a computer functions. And of course, some of the ideas around creating circuits and logic gates and all that helps you think like a programmer. So I think it definitely led me into being a software engineer. The idea that he would rather hire somebody that has that degree versus not, I think makes a lot of sense, but I think that degree says more about the person's strength in general, about being dedicated and devoted to complex tasks over time. A strong quality in a software engineer, programmer, coder, whatever you want to say, is the ability to think abstractly. And school is a great way of doing that, right? You're tasked with thinking about things in general ways that you maybe are not necessarily motivated to think about, but asked to think about, and applying your intellect in that way and being able to be interested in the process of thinking itself is a testament to the type of person that you are. Anyway, we have a great discussion. 2015, December 12th, so a year ago, show. We had Aline Lerner on. She's the founder of Interviewing.io, and she's subsequently been interviewed quite a bit in the media about the interviewing process. And a lot of the take of that of her interests and such is on discrimination in the interviewing process and trying to eliminate that through tools, which is admirable. Here at Netflix, most of the engineers are male and most of them are white. And that's indicative of the Silicon Valley, as you know. So working to make sure that we don't continue that pattern of hiring the same type of people that are currently working is essential on getting a more balanced workforce. And of course, there's studies about the benefit of having diversity in the way of thinking and a way of looking at the world. I mean, the reason why a lot of software looks the way it works, it does, is because a lot of white guys are creating it. You can kind of see this in some of the tools. There is a larger concentration of women at Pinterest than at Twitter or Facebook. And that's just a side effect of how they created their culture, I'd assume. But if you use the tools, you might notice a difference in how they function. At the same time, this abstract language of especially touch devices is growing so quickly that to see any kind of similarity and assume that that's because of the people that made it, it's also because the field feeds upon itself, right? Little ideas of, I mean, taking swiping left, swiping right, that idea, once it becomes developed and is a language of communication with that device, people will take advantage of it and developers will take advantage of it. So I wouldn't put too much emphasis on the actual design and interaction of the device being associated directly to the gender imbalance of the different companies. But I would say that there's a factor there about the lack of diversity affecting development. So I take it as read that a more diverse workforce produces a better way of thinking, a more engaged way of thinking without being able to – the basic idea is that if a whole bunch of people think the same way and there's some problem that needs to be solved with a different way of thinking, adding more people in to think differently produces the effect of possibly finding that other path. That's the general concept. In any case, the technical interview, which Alex mentioned and comes up a lot when we're talking about who's in the field and who's not in the field, you have to get through that technical interview to get a job at any of these software companies. And I've done a lot of interviewing here for Netflix, and it is extremely hard to be completely aware that a person that does really well on an interview and a person that doesn't do very well on an interview does not show a correlation to how well they do in the job. At some level, this makes sense because, of course, a lot of what we're doing as software engineers is the technical problem, but it's also the organization of ideas and thoughts into a structured form, which isn't necessarily about solving an algorithmic problem. It's about communicating and understanding other people's needs and other developers. Most of what you're doing when you're working on a large software system is comprehending how the system works so that you can modify it and engage with it without making it too complex. Spaghetti code is normally what's described. You want it to be easy to understand for anybody. Those things are not the interviewing process. The interviewing process is much more a test of ability to think through a problem that is, a computer science problem. If you're extremely good at technical interviewing, that doesn't mean you're extremely good at doing a software engineer, programmer, developer role. So when I do the interviews, I try to focus on what my own biases are. And if the bias is such that someone that's different than what I'm used to interacting with as an engineer doesn't produce as much goodwill in my heart, if you will, in my mind, in the interviewing process, that tells me something about myself much more than about them. So speaking of development and software engineering, the rest of the show is going to be quite dense with content about programming. My friend and colleague, Michael Polson, wrote a couple blog entries that I helped edit to some level. And then he did a Node conference talk in the EU about this idea. And we're going to go into some depth about this idea. And this is a programming communication idea. If you don't really understand software development, this conversation is going to be less than clear because I'm not making it completely transparent. It would take too long to make it transparent to everyone. But I'll just give some subtle background and an example of Netflix. I'll just describe exactly how Netflix actually functions. The iPhone, or let's just take the TV, for example. your Netflix television application, what happens is there's an operating system on the television that the manufacturer, like Samsung or something, has made. And inside there, they've downloaded our development package called NRDP, Netflix Ready Device Player. And that's a multiple version app that's actually developed at Netflix. And it's a platform that allows us to run our Netflix apps. And when I say our Netflix apps, we have one television app, but really we have lots of television apps because we're continually, every once a week, I think, we push a new version with new features. These are A-B tests sometimes. These are new ways of showing content. Last month, we started showing that as you browse through to check out movies, instead of seeing a still picture, you actually see moving video in the what we call the Lolomo, which we'll get into a second with Michael. In any case, to get that new application every week, what your TV does when it starts up is it actually contacts our server and says, hey, you got anything for me? And our server will respond with a payload of application, a whole bunch of code, and say, yeah, run this. And then the TV will start up the application. So actually starts the application phones us, gets a new version of itself, if you will, and then runs it. This is all kind of like a web application. Once that application starts running, you'll see the Netflix logo, and then relatively quickly you'll see a display of images that you can browse through, continue watching, what's new, you know, horror, television, whatever different rows of content you'll get. So all that first, like loading the Netflix logo and then deciding to start rendering all these other images, that's the application. Once it wants to start rendering images, it has to contact the server again. And this time it says, hey, the person that's logged in right now is Frank. And Frank's password is blah, blah, blah. Is that good? And then the system will send back, yep, you're good. And here, Frank, here's all your configuration settings on how the app should work, what language it should be in, and things of that nature. And also, here is a giant payload of all the different movies that we think you'll like. And that has to do with the algorithms that we are famous for at Netflix, right? So that payload of data, those multiple payloads of data, all require the television to talk to the Netflix servers. And I won't get into detail right now about the Netflix servers and how they actually function, but really they're virtual servers in Amazon's system. That's how we actually serve our data. And when the request happens, saying Frank wants his list of movies, what actually occurs on the back end is that little tiny, what we call an endpoint that's serving Frank's needs, all the television needs of a certain version, that thing's going to contact a whole bunch of different services inside the Netflix internal infrastructure, if you will. It needs the list of movies that are important. And for each one of those movies, it needs to know the URL, the universal reference link, the way, the place, the image for that movie shows up. So when you see your screen of videos, you'll see a picture of like a house of cards, and that's one of the movies. Well, that image itself is on another server somewhere. And so we have to get the location of that image, send it back to the client, and also maybe the bookmark. Let's say you've started watching the movie and you're 20% done episode 2 or something. We want to know that so that when the TV says play, we play from that point on. That's an important aspect. And some of those features are unique to Frank, like that bookmark is unique to Frank. And some of those things are generic to the show, like the box art, the artwork for House of Cards is unique to the show. But it's not unique to the show. It's unique to English US version of the show, because if we release that show globally and in French, House of Cards probably says something else. So all of these aspects of what stuff is needed for Frank to see his list of movies on his television are coming from different locations and need to be stitched up uniquely for Frank. And the way we currently do that is using what's called REST, and we use JSON, or this JavaScript object notation, which is kind of the de facto way of communicating between client and server in the world, and also sometimes between server and microservice. Those all different features that give you the bookmark and give you the image and all that, those are actually microservices that are inside the Netflix infrastructure. And it's interesting, you know, prior to working at Netflix, I didn't know a lot of these things. And of course, now I know these quite well, but I also know the people that write all these little pieces and I know where they sit. Which is kind of a fun way to help me think through problems, having a geographic location. So I'm currently, for example, on the third floor of the Netflix building E. And it's kind of the holidays, so most people are gone. So I took an hour to record this little bit. And this floor actually has Netflix Ready device people here. There's a guy, Steve, that's down the aisle a little bit that works on part of that project, and I've chatted with him before about it. Anyway, kind of neat stuff. So let's go ahead and listen to Michael and Malt Polson and I talk about maybe replacing JSON as the format for interexchange between client and server and between server and microservices. So you've been a professional developer for 6 years?
Yes, maybe. Yeah, sometime in 2010, I tried to start my own company and then eventually made it out here.
What's your schooling?
Computer science.
Oh.
Sweet, sweet science. I used to tell people I'd make sweet science to computers. It didn't...
Didn't work?
Didn't work.
No, it's not working for me either.
Yeah, it doesn't work for most people.
So a while ago, you came and asked me. We both work Netflix together, obviously. And in fact, the same team now, which is
kind
of cool.
Yeah.
And a while ago, you came and said, hey, Lyle, will you read this and tell me if it makes sense to someone that doesn't understand what the hell I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And it was just an introduction to flat buffers. Actually, it was an advanced level discussion about flat buffers. And I hadn't heard of them at that time. Yeah. And as I read through the article, I thought, wow, I've been doing stuff wrong with server-client communication in JavaScript or web apps for a long time because I fell in love with what you were talking about. Okay?
Yeah.
Give me like the skinny on what flat buffers are, and then we're going to try to talk about how they work.
So I'm surprised you fell in love with my poor writing, but...
I didn't say I fell in love with your writing. I said I fell in love with flat buffers.
I know, it's usually a barrier to entry. let's see. So flat buffers, it's just another, you know, soup du jour of many types of encoding formats. So in the web world, we think JSON because it's... I mean, JSON looks like JavaScript to the point where it is 1999 something standard. So it's literal JavaScript. And due to that, I think... you don't think of any sort of alternative. So therefore, you don't try to investigate anything else. The only thing, if I asked you what other encoding formats are there, you'd naturally say XML.
Right, yeah.
And so then, but all it is just like JSON in the sense that it has a bunch of keys and values. There are some differences. It's not dynamic, meaning you have to know the shape of your data before it comes down.
The schema.
Yep, the schema. And it's done all in binary. So that means when you make a schema, you then generate a bindings file in which instead of calling like, say, data.title, you call data.title as a function,
mm-hmm.
and that returns your title.
When you're doing web apps, you definitely think about passing data around. In fact, the form submission of a web app, right, the actual form itself is a key value submission of data.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the values can actually be arrays.
Yep.
And it's text. Like, it's normally just text. And of course, it's URL encoded so that, you know, you can actually transport via a GET or POST. But other than that, it's lots of string data.
Yep.
And that means it's got extra characters like delimiters and quotes just to be able to allow a system to parse it. And all that kind of format, that's what JSON is, right? It's kind of another structured format that is well-structured with escape characters appropriately and the whole deal.
Yep.
In fact, when you're passing JSON over the wire, it, of course, is also URL encoded. And I've always known that data format is noisy in the sense that there's a lot of extra replication. Let's say we work at Netflix, we'll talk about movies. If we're passing, you know, 30 different movie titles with the title and the, maybe the ID of it and maybe the URL of the box art,
mm-hmm.
if I'm passing that, I have to name each one of those videos, I have to name a property called title and then video and then URL, for example. And in each one of those, I'm going to have that repeated phrasing. And right off the bat, you know that that's replication of data and therefore it's waste. And the argument I always get about that is, well, that's okay. We're gzipping everything anyway.
Yep. It's a valid argument in the sense that gzipping does really reduce the size. Like I compared the difference between flat buffer of the same data versus JSON. And I mean, for the most part, JSON either won or was equal. And by one, I mean, you know, 500K worth of data became maybe 500 bytes smaller when it was JSON versus mm-hmm. flat buffers because there's some control bits that are a part of flat buffers that aren't a part of JSON.
Right. And because since you're doing binary data, you have
There's some offsets and things that don't serialize as well if you have heavy amount of text. And it also, looking back, I had a couple poor ways I set up my flat buffer so that the encoding or the gzipping wasn't as good.
Right. And that's the thing is gzipping, it happens to match really well with JSON. Like
yeah,
they
fit it works, really well it works together. Out well.
Yeah. So that's been, you know, the argument. And then the other aspect and the thing that the reason why you really are looking at flat buffers as such a serious win in the development you do at Netflix has to do with the memory footprint of a television and being able to, if you will, I'm going to use the term parse, even though it's not really parse, the data on the client side. But so let's talk about what happens for JSON. So, you know, a JSON document, you know, it's hard, of course, to talk about this on radio. And theoretically, the people yep. that are listening understand at some level what JSON is. I'll have a link on the show notes to actually describe this. And the link to your two articles, that really does it justice, your blog entries. But in general, that idea of having a group of objects that are these videos with properties and values – that's the form of a JSON document. So it just repeats over and over again. Basically, an array of those is what yep. you would actually get. Though, can array be a root node in Java? No, it can't, right? JSON
it
has to start with an object.
In proper JSON, it can't be, but in JSON.parse, it can be.
So basically, everybody can use it that way, and they do.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah.
So what happens on the client side, on a client that's actually getting JSON? They first have to URL unencode it, which is probably handled by the web server at some level.
Yep. At some point, it gets to your application. Usually, you either – so, I mean, with – you can request things as, you know, application/JSON, and a lot of that's just handled for you, and it just comes out as an object in the JavaScript world.
Right. Like but, if you're running a node server or you're in a client of a browser, yeah. when the browser sees that it's a JSON, text.json, MIME data, it just has it parses it for you and puts it in your memory space.
Yes. But in reality, it has to go from whatever came across the wire. It has to get into some sort of – properly parsed string format in which then it does the – if you've ever been to the JSON.org website, there's a big finite automata of how to read every single character and go through that. It has to run through that with every single character. So if you have 500,000 characters in your JSON, you have 5,000 or 500,000 operations it has to perform flowing through this automaton.
So what you're saying is that the first thing it does is it's parsing out the characters, and these of course could be
It expects curly brace, then it expects right. a double quote, and then it expects a series of, you know, characters plus potentially escapees and all that.
And then it when it closes with a quote. And so the first thing it does is it goes through the entire document assuring that it is the right valid form.
I believe it does that as it goes. I would imagine any modern parser would not do it.
Wouldn't do it
pass.
Twice. Yeah, so be. As it goes, it actually goes, okay, it looks like I've got an object start or an array start, right? Okay, yeah. I've got an array start, so I'm going to make a new equivalent to what you would do in JavaScript by making a new array. Of yep. course, this is at a lower level without yep. the JavaScript interpreter potentially, filling up the memory space. And then it goes ahead and says, okay, I have a new object here. So it creates a reference to a new object, instantiates the object. Then it says, it looks like I've got a property called title. And then it puts in the string of title. And all of that requires the colon and the quote and all that to be in
yes.
perfect order.
It's essentially, if you ever worked with like the V8 system or any of those things, I mean, the outside world can read it, but it has to ask the engine for an object in memory, because everything has to be stored in the proper heap space and very well controlled. So you have to still interact with the engine. You still have to do a lot of work to create these objects. They're not free.
Okay. And of course, you could assume that most JavaScript runtimes have the parsing of JSON as fast as they possibly can.
Yes. Stringification is done usually at the JS layer, but the parsing is usually done at the C++ layer.
So when you say stringification, you mean output of JSON.
Yes. When you take an object into a string, it's almost always done, which we can talk about that. There's some interesting things that happen.
That happen there. Okay. So that means if you're going to send a 500K document that is just a whole bunch of videos with the same properties I'm talking about, what has to happen the very first time is you have to, in memory, get this string and then process out. And as you have that memory, that string that's being processed in memory, you're then allocating objects on the heap. All of that has to be in memory prior to doing anything with this thing.
Correct.
And that, to me,
it's an N operation.
Right.
Like minimally, you have to go yeah. through every single character
and
create.
And memory.
Objects. Yeah.
Yeah.
M amount of objects, they're going to have some sort of amount of footprint that is
right.
non-trivial.
And then it's not uncommon to actually have in your client code some kind of model representation of what the data is. This would probably – we just hold an array called videos or something and mm-hmm. that would be all. And when doing that, you would, if you did it correctly, you wouldn't make another copy of it. So effectively,
yep.
there you'd go. Yep. Okay. So now that to me doesn't sound that bad, and at first without knowing more about flat buffers, it doesn't sound that bad. And it seems like, well, then you've got your object in memory and it's exactly the way you want it, right? It's it's verbose and all that thing. The other thing about the array is that, you know, we're going to have this video ID and later we're going to have to look them up. So actually we're going to probably have a model locally that will translate this into a faster lookup potentially. So you don't have to parse through that entire list of them.
Yep.
So you'd have now an index of some sort that you have an array of IDs or pointing to the actual title.
Correct.
So you might actually transform this on the fly is another way to think
you're gonna
about
create it. You're going to create a map and add a bunch of keys to it.
Right. So now you're going to duplicate the data. Once.
Yeah,
maybe.
You're going to make, you're at least going to create a new object, and keys aren't light. As you add more and more keys, they become progressively more costly.
And that's just the structure of how you deal with objects in JavaScript.
Yeah.
There's no way around that.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want fastest possible lookup.
Right, right.
Which if your array is like size 3, then you might as well just
flip through it. Yeah. Okay.
I like to generalize.
Yeah. So flat buffers actually take advantage of a different data structure.
Correct.
And that is a bit array? A byte array?
Yeah, byte array.
Describe when that came around in JavaScript and how prolific it is.
I don't know when exactly it came out with JavaScript. I know that you know, it's like a uint 8 array. So it's an unsigned 8-bit integer array. And that means it can be values 0 through 256 or 255. Yeah, 0 through 255. And all that is, it's just simply an array in which not the classic JavaScript array. It's more like classic array style. So you give it a size, you actually allocate a certain contiguous chunk of memory, and you say, okay, I'm going to now have this as my, you know, my data, and then you can fill it in. And once it's full, you can't just keep adding. You have to create a new array, you know, like it's just classic array style. So it gives you a little bit lower level primitive too.
When you say classic array style, think of using C.
Yeah,
and
C or Java or any of the standard languages.
So what that really is a pointer to memory.
Yeah.
Like one, that whole byte array is going to be one block of memory contiguous as
one
the operating
block.
System does.
Yeah.
And so when you're talking about the index of it, you're not talking about the index of the third collection in there. You're talking about the index at a location pointing to a character.
Yes.
Or a 256 byte.
Yeah.
Okay. And that when I really started paying attention to that in the JavaScript space is when we started using – when ASIM started becoming really popular and you started seeing like full C applications, like game engines running in JavaScript context, the way they're dealing with all data is typed in byte arrays.
Yes. It is it's the standard for the rest of the performance world to use byte arrays.
Right.
Because you don't – there's all sorts of optimization tricks you don't have to do.
And one of the tricks you're not doing is you're not creating JavaScript objects with property names, right? So you actually do have one – you can think of it as an object in the sense that all things in JavaScript are object and therefore that array is an object. Mm. But it's a constant, right? You can't modify it. Munge it, can you?
You can. You can't. Right now – so I was fortunate enough to get a PR and they actually approved it. I don't know why they did, but they did. It actually contained lint, which was funny. I had to do a subsequent PR to clean it up. But yeah, you can mutate scalar values, meaning like numbers. So that's more interesting, I think, to a Netflix world in the sense that video data is pretty much a constant. We're never changing video data. But user data about a video, which is pretty much a rating, is a scalar value. It's not a string value. Therefore, I can mutate that. I can create the space for it and mutate it later.
And the reason you can mutate is that integer that you define at that location is an integer. So any valid integer, whatever size you're talking about, is valid in the data structure.
Yeah.
Because, of course, shifting the index around, just shifting the space of that byte array is not possible because that is a memory pointer.
I'm sure there's some tricks that you could replace like strings for like strings. Like if you had a same size string, I'm sure you could actually write something on top of it to, you know, do that. But at the end –
but then you're dealing with buffer
space. You have fragmentation issues. There's all sorts of crazy things that come up.
And luckily in our situation, we don't do a lot of modifying data. I mean, the thing you're talking about of ratings, the 5-star ratings or the percentage rating stuff that we'll be doing later this year.
Is all int
next
based.
Year. Is all int based, so it's easy to change.
Yep.
Another example of an int that we use is the bookmark position of a title. And that's one of those values that it's basically a percentage of through the film you are.
Yep.
It's actually the amount of time through the film you are.
Seconds,
but these are all numbers.
Whatever.
Right, seconds. Yeah. And so those numbers change a lot as you do things, but and they're potentially client-side, though we normally do round robins to most of the stuff on the server.
We pretty much always do round robin for that kind of stuff.
Yeah. The only difference to that actually is as we launched the offline mode for Android and iOS, we had to start caching these things locally. And though both those applications are actually native applications, they're not using JavaScript to do these things. They get to take advantage of the typed language structures that have Objective-C and Java. But in any case, I digress. Let's talk about the data structure of how the flat buffer actually works. So it's a giant array of bytes, and I'm assuming that in this array of bytes is some kind of lookup table to talk about what type of data you have in it. I mean, you talked about the schema earlier.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly it. So you get, say, this 500K worth of data, and you instantiate a new object and just say, hey, I'm a new Lolamo. That's, for us, that's a Lolamo, or for Netflix, we call them Lolamos. Let me just get a couple terminologies. Lolamo stands for list of movies. It's been here longer than I've been here.
So and if you open up any of our applications, like the television application, and you see a list of films that go from the left to the right, if you're in left to right language, and that's a list of movies, right? And then you go down, you see another list of movies. And these are like recently watched or new on the service or horror movies, all of these things. Those are lists of movies. So we have a list of movies.
Yes.
The Lolamo.
Yes. And so we have a Lolamo. And so you can imagine that this is a fairly large piece of data because there's a lot of movies for every single list and there's a lot of lists. So therefore, say we get a 500K chunk of just binary data.
Let's talk about the size for a second, because I think we're at Netflix and people are interested in what we do. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, I think on the iOS app, I think a row of movies, the list itself, I think is 75 long.
Yep. It's 35 by 75 is the standard Lolamo.
35 rows deep or down, if you will.
And it goes anywhere between 32 to 37 is what I've seen. And somewhere between 70 to 76.
And these all change by platform and memory space and also by region you're in. So like if you're in a country that doesn't have a lot of titles, it would be smaller, obviously.
Yep.
And then it also has to do with
your preferences.
The preferences, yeah. Okay. So go on. Oh, and tests we're running. Like we'll add new rows for certain purposes,
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a pretty large block of data. You say 500K.
Yeah. That's just – I mean, we did a small hack day project that did a lot of very – we just took the main idea of the gallery and put it out there, and ours was at like 640K.
Okay.
To display everything that you'd need to display a gallery.
And the things
all
you need
– 35 by 75 rows.
Right. And the things you need to do that effectively is the title, the URL of the box art.
Yep.
You need also –
The synopsis. You need a sexy synopsis is what we used to call it. I think they got rid of that term.
Because it's offensive.
It may be offensive at some point in the future. So I think it's now like the sweet synopsis. I don't know.
And the list titles.
So you need two different synopses, one for the MDP page and one for the actual
MDP
item.
Is movie display page.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Okay. There's a lot of terms we'll shout out. Hopefully we'll define them all.
I'll do what I can.
You need the ratings, which is a number between 1 to 50. Yes, 1 to 50.
Oh, why do we do 1 to 50?
Well, because it's the best kind of resolution because we do 1/10 of a star.
Oh, right.
So you can do 5 stars, you get it. I think we're going to another rating system. I guess you could have 0 through 100 then. But you also need 8 different badgings. I think it's 8. Is Ultra HD, is HDR, Dolby 5.1.
All those icons that show up. Yeah.
So there's actually a lot of information. Running time, year it was created, which funny thing, when we did our hack day project year created, we are off by 1894 at one point. it's a really weird number to be off by, but it happens also to be the first show. So we were just trying to pack the data as small as possible, and the first show I believe was 1894, and then we forgot to subtract that off, so we had like this offset into, I don't know, it was a dumb plan, but
anyway,
it was 3 a.m. It was a bad problem.
That's what hack days are for.
Yeah. And so like there's a lot of information. Is original. There's certain type of badgings we do extra for.
Is new as well. Sometimes it's new on the client side.
There's just a huge amount of hero art. So that's the big images you'll see if you're using television. So there's usually 3 of them.
Basic idea is that what you want is when the app starts up and you've logged in, you've switched your profile, and I've chosen my profile, and I want to see a whole bunch of movies. I want all that stuff to arrive at one point. And then after that, as I scroll around, all that's being grabbed is the actual image data. The URLs are being loaded. And this allows me to do things like quickly go through a whole bunch of rows or open a display page really quick that shows me the title automatically. And all that stuff is there without me waiting. So it feels very snappy. That's why we want this payload quick.
It not just feels snappy. If you do like a progressive requesting of data, I think Netflix is lucky in the sense that we have a very defined set of data we show. I think it's much harder at a place like Facebook or Twitter where you're scrolling down and it's infinitely grabbing more and more and more. So they have to do this virtualized kind of grabbing. We don't necessarily have to do that. We can get all the data in a pretty efficient manner, which means that as the user scrolls around, we don't have to make subsequent requests for data, thus, locking the thread, doing a bunch of garbage collection, because as you make requests, you necessarily have to generate garbage. And if you're using JSON, you have to generate even more garbage. So there's like a lot of things that happen as you scroll, especially right now on like on our television app, we have to do a lot of scrolling, a lot of fetching. Like you can see it in debugging.
The television app actually is doing progressive downloading as you scroll
around. We are doing
around.
Progressive downloading. Yeah. We have a whole bunch of complex data structures around keeping a limited amount of memory in at any one point.
Right, because these television platforms, you know, they run on old VCRs, well, not anymore, yeah, but TVs, and the memory footprint is whatever the manufacturer makes, effectively.
Yeah, we could have something, I think, something like 70 megs total at all. So all in memory, all surface cache, all everything, like, right, can be really, really small is all we get. So we have to be careful.
You're saying surface cache, you're talking about the actual pixels that are the bitmap pixels that represent the screen,
yeah,
at any
our
one
whole
time.
App has to run in a very small amount of memory.
Right, right. And then I on
and by the, very small, I mean very small in like 2005 standards.
Yeah, sure.
And then the 70s guys.
And then, you know, can the iOS app, which I'm more familiar with, is my kind of primary platform. We also grab the entire Lolomo list, all that data in the beginning. And the reason for that is that mobile devices just have inconsistent bandwidth connections. And so you kind of don't want to be in a situation where you've went ahead and did like a momentum scroll and just things are not there. Yeah. Because that's kind of discouraging for a person. So we have enough data to render everything you need to be able to kind of engage with the experience all at once. Okay. So doing that for the TV – in the situation where you're actually creating JavaScript objects for all of this, would actually not work. And that's one of the reasons you're doing this progressive, smarter kind of loading of destroying stuff and recreating stuff on the fly in the traditional way. So your Hackday project, going with flat buffers, allows you to have a lower footprint because – so let's talk about how – we were talking about the schema of the thing. So we've got the list of movies. Okay, go on.
So we have a list of movies and say it takes up 640K. So we create a new object literally called like flatbuffers.lolomo. I go, okay, new Lolomo, here's your block of data. And from here on out, we didn't do anything to that data. It doesn't even look to make sure that it's actually a Lolomo. It just simply goes, okay, I'm a Lolomo. You and have rows. You have your length of rows. You have your, you know, UUID that is the Lolomo. You have perhaps some other basic bits of controlling on it. And so now, even though it hasn't done any parsing, you now have access to the Lolomo
and
the
fields.
And when
you say have access, you're pointing to the memory that is that byte array.
You have you're pointing to the memory that is the byte array.
Typed array?
Have,
is it called typed array? What is it
it's
called?
It's a typed array. You can call it byte array. You can call it...
It's called typed array. We should call the right terms. Okay.
Well, it is a typed array, but it's also a byte array. A uint 8 array is a byte array.
Okay.
In the traditional
that's why you didn't
8
correct
bits
me earlier.
To a byte array.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's not a nibble array, you know, 4 bits to a nibble.
No, let's not get into that.
In case you get...
Okay, so you're saying is that you've started up this one object, which is Lolomo object, and it points to that data set as its data back.
But it's done no parsing.
No parsing.
So let's just imagine the network just said, okay, hey, here you go. Here's your data. So what you've done is you've pointed to that data and say, okay, I understand it now. I have 5 methods or 10 methods or however many fields you have on Lolomo to be able to understand that data.
Okay.
And so now that means – it's called like an – so what this essentially gives you is kind of like an allocation-free idea. So allocation – there's two different kind of memory things. There's zero copy, which involves from the network card to your application.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's allocation-free, which is from your application and through your application. So now we have a chunk of data that we don't have to convert it into an alternative structure to understand it. So like
did you have to modify the JavaScript engine to handle this or the Netflix Ready Device platform that everything is built on?
Anything except for there's a certain older version of Netflix that can't handle it that I think represents 5% of the devices out there can't have typed arrays because we just didn't have it in our engine at that point.
So most of these operating systems, effectively what's going to happen here is that the JavaScript engine that you guys were running in the Netflix Ready Device platform has the ability to say, oh, thank you, network card. You've just given me a block of memory. I'm going to make that a typed array. And that's it. It's not like I'm going to copy this, parse it, do any of that kind of stuff we had to do with the JavaScript file. It's just it has a memory address from the system, actually from the network card to the application, to the operating system level to the application. And the application just says, cool, I'm not going to do anything else with it except for reference it.
Hand it on off.
All right. So we're talking about a memory pointer.
It's essentially that's all really a typed array is. I mean,
okay,
if you remember
cool.
from your old school days, you just increment a pointer to go through, you know, a char star. So it's
so
essentially
this,
that.
This Lolomo object that you've created, it has to be very aligned with what the server did to generate this byte. The schema file has to be kind of baked into this JavaScript.
So that's the nice part is when you have a flat buffer file, it's like a .fbs file. It generates, you know, you can generate JavaScript, you can generate all the different bindings for it. It does all the little endian stuff. If you're not familiar with little endian,
you don't have to be because there you go.
Yeah. It does it all for you, so you don't even think about it. So when you ask for an integer, it gets it out, and it properly gets it out in the way.
Well, maybe we should talk for a second about how you actually create it in the first place, because at some point you had to tell a computer system, hey, I want to take this data from wherever and put it into this byte array, type array. How did you do that? We're at a Groovy layer, this or Java layer, when you actually generate it. So what does that process look like?
So that process, you got to – so JSON when you build, let's just say we have a video. Let's just say we have a list that contains
that array of titles,
an array of
yeah, that the thing
an
we
array
about
of videos, mm-hmm. and each video has some fields on
title,
it,
title, URL, yeah. and ID.
So you actually have to do it backwards when you build flat buffers. So first, you'd create all your videos, and then from your videos, you'd create your row, and then say, "Hey, here's your list of videos that is the row." So in the JavaScript world, if you were to just create this using just JavaScript objects, you'd go, okay, I have a list. Now I'm going to add a movie. Okay, now I'm done adding enough movies. Mm-hmm. Or this way, it's like, create a movie. Now that I'm done, here's the array that represents those movies.
Got it.
And so you kind of do it backwards.
And that's so that the bindings can be created correctly.
Yeah, so all the offsets into the memory.
Okay,
It's too hard to explain without a whiteboard.
Let's talk about the offsets and stuff. I know it's really hard to do this in radio, but hey, we're trying.
Yeah.
So the general concept here is that you're going to have some kind of lookup data, and that actually is, with flat buffers, is encoded into the JavaScript or whatever language generates for you. So when you say you get these helper methods and stuff, all the logic about where the offsets are and what actually happens and how you do this, the stuff I'm about to explain, is actually codified for you. You just run it.
It's behind a binding. So you call dot title. It actually goes, okay, I'm going to read from my offset plus 4 into this, read to a string, read the length of the string. Like, it does all this magic stuff for you, but you just get a string out.
Right.
So you don't know.
And the cool thing is the only time there's actually a string object created is at that moment that you want to use it.
Yes, when you want to put it on the screen.
That's when the actual string object gets created.
Yes. Because you don't need it otherwise. Like, we don't need – that's the weird part. It's like, if you had 35 by 75 movies, and you have that, you're going to – in JSON, you're going to literally parse out 35 by 75
– objects.
Like synopses.
Yeah.
Which you only display really one synopsis at a time. So why would you display – I don't know what 35 by 75 is off the top of my head.
Right.
Large, 2100 plus.
Yeah.
And so –
that's a lot of big
text
blocks.
Yeah, that's a lot of text blocks just to parse for no reason. Literal no reason.
So to be clear, what's actually happening in this structure, just so we kind of comprehend it, is that there is pointers that kind of – so every video would take up a very static amount of space in this thing. So
Mostly static.
Okay.
Yeah, strings can be whatever size you want them. They just baked in at that moment.
There's actually a data structure here, kind of like a database does data structures, where indices point to other blocks of memories that have the data in them.
Yes.
So that your index is in there. So what's actually going to happen is you're going to read the very first bit of data is going to be like the title that should – that if you ask for this location, the string that represents the title, which is this first location, zero, position 0, is over here in memory later on in the flat buffer. And then position 2, which is the video ID, is a number. So actually that number we know is going to be an integer, so it can be right here. So it's just a number in the code.
You can imagine that.
And the next block would be a string as well, it would point out. And then that would be maybe 5 bytes that would define that first video.
And they're usually always uniform. Long as you define your fixed length ones first and then your string ones last, you only get a little bit different. So it's a V table at that point, which means it compresses perfectly down to whatever is the most optimal compression.
And all the complexity of generating this is part of the flat buffer library, which is a Google library?
It's a Google library, yeah.
Okay.
It really originally started as protobufs. Everyone uses the term protobufs, but protobufs have all the weaknesses of JSON essentially. You have to parse it all to understand it. It's binary, but why would you want a schema, parcel, long-cost thing? You might as well get all the benefits of a schema.
Okay. So, what kind of performance gain did you see in moving from JSON parsing and generating versus flat buffers?
So I made a kind of a microservice-y node application. So let me first explain that. So you have a bunch of clients that request into this service aggregator. So pretty much all node middleware is usually a service aggregator, meaning it goes out and it calls for a bunch of different data. It gets all that data, it packages it in a way that the client's going to understand, and then hands it off to the client.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a bunch of clients that call to a service aggregator. The service aggregator takes each request, goes off, and gets a LoloMo for that user by its ID, brings it back in, then it crawls that whole LoloMo and grabs every single video's ID and then sends that off to a rating service in which returns the rating for that user. And then we have to now merge that rating back into the LoloMo and then send it back off to the user. So something that sounds very Netflixy.
Right.
You get a list of data and you have to kind of mutate it a little bit, then send it off to the user. So in classic JSON mode, we were able to do about 40,000 videos, I think, per second, right around there. So that's like, however, doesn't matter how big or small the LoloMo was. At some point when it was like one video LoloMos, the like I had the flood so many requests in that it actually started tanking performance. But as it got to about like
in your test system, you set up a whole bunch of virtual clients, the users asking for stuff, like 100 of them or whatever, and they said get your Lilamo, and then all these requests come in, and then it's like, you know, 1500 videos per user, and you're like doing all this stuff. So you just basically ran the load until your system kind of was taxed,
unable to handle process anything else.
And so, that's your JSON floor, if you will. That's your target to get better at.
So it was about 40,000 videos for JSON. So I was like, okay, that's I think that sounds pretty good to me. Why not?
Depends on what kind of process. So then
I don't want to give away why it was at 40,000 yet. So then I did flat buffers, and it was right around 200 and some thousand. So I was like, wow, that's a significant difference. So why does it, like, doesn't matter how big or small the Lilamo is, I'm always stuck at these two values, 40,000 for that. And so I'm like, doesn't matter. So obviously I'm doing something. So what's causing the throttling? What is the bottleneck? Yeah. So then I, you know, did a top and IF top. So top tells you what processes are taking up the most amount of CPU, and IF top tells you what is like the most network ones. Mm-hmm. I think IF top, you actually have to go download and all that. So it's the same principle. And so when I looked at it, JSON was pegging our CPU at about like 95% or whatever, and the system was taking off some small percentage and all that.
And this, and what you're saying is this microservice, which is a node, you were doing JSON parsing and stuff like that, because that's JSON how you would parsing, do this kind of thing.
Yeah. Filling in all the or doing JSON parsing, building this out, sending it off, getting more, you know, the ratings request, filling in the values, and then restringifying it and sending it across the
client. Because when node says, hey, I've got a video ID for a user, I'm going to go ask this other service for the Lilamo, it's actually returning that Lilamo in JSON, and then it has to parse it again. Because, of course, these are all services through HTTP. Okay.
So I did that. And so the aggregator for JSON, which literally the only difference between the two is a little control bit I was sending to the aggregator service. Like, respond to me in JSON, respond to me in flat buffers. And so when I did it with JSON, we were pegged on the CPU, but only 50% network utilization, meaning I had plenty of free time to like send more data out, but I had no CPU to do anything with, which means I didn't do any compression at that point.
Oh, that would have taken more
CPU. Means I couldn't actually compress any of that data back to the user without sacrificing videos per second. So that was pretty interesting. And then flat buffers, I looked at that. I was 100% network utilized, meaning I could not get any faster unless if I beefed up my Amazon instance, but only about like 40% CPU.
Nice.
So I had plenty of time to encode videos.
Right. Or compress.
Yeah, I didn't do any compression. Yeah. So, I mean, if I would have compressed, I would have had a way larger number. My expectations were a lot higher. I was having troubles with Node's zlib.
Yeah. So it's a cool side effect that a lot of the delay or the hit was in processing power.
Yep.
Just parsing the friggin' JSON. That's all it really was doing, right?
There's an article. I forget the name of it. It's search up scholarly articles for zero copy, and there's a link in it, a citing that says 67% of computer operations is copying memory, and that's an Intel site. Yeah, so Intel tends to know things about what computers do. I hear they're pretty good at them. And so that's JSON's just, you know, causing that problem. Because what made FlatBuffer so good or used so little memory is that the network card would respond with, here's your chunk of data. I would then just only crawl the data looking for IDs, send those IDs off to another service. When I got the values back, I would literally just merge in that data into that same block of bytes because I can mutate scalar values, and then just point the network card again to that same block and send it off. So therefore, I never had to once parse a single string out of there.
In fact, there's never a copy.
It's allocation free at that point, meaning that I didn't have to allocate alternative structures to do stuff to that. It's not zero copy because I was in node necessarily copies, and I didn't set up the system to do zero copy from the network card to the app. So
you could fine tune that as well.
Do something there, but at that point, we were already so done with the network.
It was such a big win.
Yeah, it was such a big win that we couldn't get it faster due to the network card. So I did it at some point beef up the instance and got it up to like a million videos per second. But
so one of the things that XML promised, and first off, I've been developing a little bit longer than you, and I remember when XML was the new hotness. And
at one point.
And one of the things that was so great about it was that one of the things that was argued that was so great about it for services and such was that a human can read it.
Yes.
Like this, a human can read it it's like the third thing you say about XML, right?
Yeah.
Structured markup language that you can define your own schema, and a human can read it. Like, that was always the way people said it. And the same thing with JSON. Like, that's a big reason. Like, whenever you do kind of a 101 or a hello world with a web service, Flickr is the one that people have used for years because you can say, hey, give me all the recent photos of cats, and it's a fun little thing to do anyway on a demo. And when you do that, the response back is JSON. The first thing you do is just kind of hit it with a curl command or something to make sure you get the load. You can see the data, and you can read through it and go, oh, look, there's a property called URL. That's the one I want. And then you'd use the URL to paint the image on the screen. So in a big way, the growth, the advanced growth of using services and APIs that, I don't know, 10 years ago, 6 years ago, whatever it was, that we had this giant explosion. And the reason why Twitter, for example, is successful is because they gave an API to their system and people used it. All of that was powered by this transparency that the web has had for a long time, that a developer can see what's going on really easily. In a flat buffer world, if someone looks at the implementation of a flat buffer system from our node service layer to our TVs, they will not be able to deal with that very well. It is a hacky level thing. You've got to be more advanced to see.
So if you just simply looked at the binary load, you would have no idea what you're looking at. I mean, you could, if you just printed it out on, like, in your bash, you would see titles and weird symbols, and you'd see some
like
strings.
A memory dump,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's not easy to look at. But one thing, so when you develop applications, what ends up happening is that though JSON is completely flexible and you can just attach whatever fields you want, what actually ends up happening is that you've implicitly defined a schema. Because obviously title has to be put on the server and title has to be pulled off on the client. You've implicitly made this agreement.
Oh, you definitely do, yeah.
And so it's a contract.
Just like Flickr couldn't, like, even though it was readable and you're seeing it and you're like, oh yeah, there's the image URL. They can't change that because once they change it, my app's going to break. I mean, it's defined. And in fact, APIs have versions because of this exact problem. Yeah.
Yes. And so alternatively, when I was developing this, so my example was quite naive. It wasn't the full Netflix application, all that.
You had to simplify it, it's hack day, right?
But when I was looking at it, we had a schema. So therefore, whenever I was like, oh yeah, what's that one field? Is it is original or just original? I couldn't remember, you know, you forget all these like little things. I could just look at an FBS file, a flat buffer file.
Right.
And go, okay, yeah, it's a Boolean. Yeah, it's right there. Okay.
Reason why you had to do the looking and such in the first place is that the idea of flat buffers is not already in your IDE and your debug tools. Because if those existed there, then your debug tools just handles for you anyway. I mean,
in a sense, but if you realize that all it did was me opening a file and looking at it, or I could have started my application, caused a request, put a debugger, looked at the JSON response, go, oh, yeah, there it is.
When the definition file is there, that's actually just as good,
it's
not
way,
better.
Yeah. It's actually significantly easier because I don't have to do any online things.
Yeah.
I can just look at a definition and go, yeah.
Well, I mean, there is a bit of belief in developer space that making things easier for developers to write code is kind of like one of the most important things you can do to be efficient in developing software. And the reason why we're so good at developing software is because we've created very verbose languages that allow us to do it and comprehend it easily. So I can see the data structures as being one of those things that if it's slightly harder, well, I mean, it's not worth it. But at some level, when it comes down to an application speaking to another service, the idea of doing that in a human readable language is really kind of asinine if you think about it in a long-term view. Yeah. Sure, the week that you're doing that API, it might be slightly convenient to have it in that form. But after that, it shouldn't. I mean, there's nothing useful about it being readable by a human after the service starts up.
Yeah. I mean, I do agree that it is super convenient having JSON from like the client to the server. But if you have a microservice setup, it does seem extra crazy to have two servers communicating in a human-readable language.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
To me, that's where it really hits home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I get why people feel like it is just easier. Like, if I just want to quickly add a field, there's nothing – I don't have to do any sort of, you know, okay, I need to add a field to the flat buffers. I need to generate a new schema. I need to update the bindings on the server, update the bindings on the client.
Oh, yeah, and old deploy apps can't hit this anymore because the schema is not matching and they wouldn't understand it necessarily.
These type of issues that can come up with just using flat buffers. Well, they also have like deprecation of fields and
– Oh, cool.
So you can actually – add or, you know, remove by deprecating fields and actually be able to do it slowly over time. So it's all the same. It's all the challenges of a strict type.
Right.
If you ever had to do Java server development, you run into this. Like our common modules, we're running into this right now with these secondary modules where we can't update them easily because, you know, it's just world.
And what are you talking about? And we'll just give a little background to that. We're both in the originals UI group, which means that we work on all the platforms. And when I say all platforms, the four main ones, which is televisions, Android, iOS, and website. And there's also – we have other apps out there too which are not developed as quickly on, like the Apple TV, and though we do touch that sometimes on that group, and also the Microsoft app, and also legacy apps. But those main four, our team kind of does – projects across all of them. So we'll decide to do a new type of row that's tall. You might have seen it in your videos. Called it's called Roar, and it's this kind of tall box art where there's normally actors in the center, and it promotes our original shows. And we've done that on, I think, all those platforms at this point. Maybe we haven't done Android yet.
Not on TV. TV is coming.
Oh, coming. Okay. Are you doing that work?
No.
Who's doing that?
Bruno.
Oh. So in any case, when we're doing that, we're creating the structure. We want to make sure to get the images that are tall. These are very common across all these platforms, so it makes sense to have that middleware code that does that in one place, and those are the common modules you're just referring to. So then we have this issue of if we change the way we want to do it, then we have to kind of tell all the clients, oh, now update and update all the clients. And that syncing, that versioning is a big part of our work, really.
Yeah.
And so it already exists, even though they're all JSON being delivered at some level. Of course, these modules are actually Java modules. But,
Groovy to be technically fair.
What do you think of Groovy?
Well, it's like JavaScript and Java had a baby. Yeah. And it is definitely not that groovy. Like the space is an operator when used in certain contexts.
Really?
Yeah. So you can do literally like foo.bar. If bar is a function and you say space and then just start typing in stuff, that will be passed into bar.
Yeah, that's kind of like Ruby.
Yeah, it's to me, that's very confusing, having space mean anything.
Friends have some good purposes, you know?
Yeah, they do. They're just – my brain is really good at processing things like in patterns. So if there's parentheses, like I instantly think function, I don't have to think about it. If there's a space, I am super confused at why.
Yeah, I get that.
So for a long time, I kept running into this issue that I was like, this method is undefined. And I was like, no, the method is – I'm not calling any methods. What are you talking about? And I didn't realize I put in that space. I know. So I'm like, what is – there's no parentheses.
The other one that – the big reason why it was so beautiful when I first saw it, you know, before I was even Java and Groovy developer, I was reading up on Groovy. A friend of mine was promoting it and suggesting it. And I thought it was so great is the closure aspect, that having closures in Java was like, oh my God.
1.6 sucks because of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And in JavaScript world, you just think in closures. You just think in, you know, in callbacks. That's just how you process everything. So having that just made it feel more felt like, oh, I don't have to define as many types of inner process communication. I'll just pass the closure. When the thing finishes, the async operation will come back and fire my closure. And oh, great.
Yeah.
And then Java 8 came along and has those anyway.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like it burned out the purpose of Groovy in a lot of ways for me.
Well, I think Groovy technically is burnt out. Like they're not maintaining it anymore.
Yeah.
2.36 or whatever it was like the last.
And the truth is what we're doing, we have Groovy in that middle layer to make it easier for UIEs, user interface engineers, to develop in our Java stack. They gave us Groovy because it was a little more friendly, and we're going to be doing a lot of like endpoint work, this point that the client works on. And we're going to be replacing that with Node. Like we've been working on that for a while. So your microservice Node translation thing you're doing is very much like what we will be doing, I think, in 2017 across our services, which brings up all these issues with these modules and stuff, how we're going to do that. It's going to be kind of fun.
It is going to be very, very fun. But, I mean, it's in the end, you know, the nice part is that we'll be able to measure all the performances. Like, in the end, we'll know what the cost of all these things are in more of a real situation, which because we abstract away data fetching and all those things, we can replace, you know, small parts and see real effects. And so hopefully also in 2017, we get chances to try out alternatives.
Right, right. Anything else you wanted to talk about real quick?
There is one thing. I do miss Google Glasses. Google Glass Lyle.
Yeah, you do?
It was a good time.
You know, I just wore those the other day. I'd made a wood project, and somebody was like, oh, how do you do that? It was actually Jesse, who was working on our team. He said, you do that with a table saw or a router? What do you use? And I described what I'd used, and then I was going to make another one for somebody. And so I was like, oh, I'll just make another one. And I put on Google Glass and recorded the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Which I thought, that'd be fun to have like a little document. And then afterwards, I was just looking at it today, and the audio is just bad. You know, like I'm used to good audio, and the Google Glass mic is like up your eyebrow. But it is kind of neat to have video from, you know, human POV. If I had a stabler head, it would be less dizzying when
What about like a GoPro?
I got to get a strap of GoPro. Yeah, staple one on my forehead.
They're stable. Well, they're stable.
They're stable. I mean, the truth is that the newer like gimbal things that auto-stabilize, that's what you need for Google Glass to actually make an effective video thing, you know. Michael Polson is a senior user interface engineer – or excuse me, senior software engineer at Netflix. Same role as me. We work on the same team. And you have a degree in computer science from –
Montana State University. Montana. It's the most beautiful place on earth.
Right on. Michael, thanks for joining me to talk about flat buffers.
Thank you.
I got to do that more often. I got to find neat people around the office and chat with them because there's some smart people here doing some interesting things. I hope that that was engaging for you. I know it's different than what we normally do. And I've also heard over the years, people just love listening to us talk, even if they don't fully understand what we're talking about. I'll mention one other thing that I'm talking about, and that is that right now, as I said, I'm recording and I'm using my Zoom H6, which is a hand field recorder with three XLR audio ins. And this is what I use every week. And then I use mic stands so that you don't hear the bad sound of the microphones, like this sound. So I'm not touching the microphone. And a windscreen and such so that you don't hear pop sounds from my voice. In any case, I record that, and the field recorder, the H6, Zoom H6, has an SD card in it. And when we're done, I pull that SD card out and I stick it in the side of my laptop and I download the audio to then edit it in Adobe Audition. Well, this week I got the new MacBook. I got the MacBook Pro 15-inch with the touch bar, and it does not come with an SD card. In fact, it comes with a quarter-inch or an eighth-inch adapter. It's actually 2.5-millimeter TRS, maybe TRRS. I'll have to find out if it's got a mic input. Oh, it's a headphone jack. And then it also comes with four USB-C connectors, which can be used for power and also for data transfer, but no SD card slot. So to do this project, I'll have to use both laptops to copy the content over, which is kind of ridiculous, of course. The touchscreen, the touch bar, I like the fingerprint scanner. Unlocking devices and approving purchases and stuff through the ID, the touch ID on the touch bar, if you will, is great. It's fun having these icons show up. Sound and the volume and lights and stuff are all really there, just like they were before. But also when you push like the function key, your top row of buttons. By the way, the touch bar is a touch surface screen. One, it's on the keyboard, right next to the keyboard. It's the height of a row of keys, and it's the place where the function keys are on a traditional laptop. And we joked about the escape key not being very functional because it's sometimes there and sometimes not. I haven't noticed a problem. It doesn't have any tactile feedback when you touch the buttons. It has visual feedback, so you kind of have to look at them. But the escape button is functional for me. It's working. It's a little strange that it sometimes changes away from escape key and sometimes changes to like the done key, which is a little odd. So this last couple of days I've been installing software and working on this machine, and the screen's beautiful, it's fast, it's light. I haven't really noticed a battery problem per se, but not having an SD slot sucks. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. I want to thank Michael Newman of Pet Style Music for our theme song. I started the Patreon process in May of 2016. It's the first time we were supported. That first month, we got $38 from people. And it's grown. Now, this last month, $112 in November from 26 different people. We had Pat Hader, Chris Irwin, Glenn Nelson, John Winston, Alexis Chen, Nirajas Clinius, Tim Ramsey, Jonas Rulio, John Vazana, Mike Coppersmith, Christy Ramsey, Double Busy, Spider Rogue, Ted Mazzo, Brandon Holway, Joe Kyle, Ben Powell, and Judy Enos. Thank you very much for dedicating some of your money every month to help make GeekSpeak happen. And thanks to Alex and also to Michael for joining me on this episode 52 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.
I have a voice that carries. So normally I don't need it. If it's in a room of 200 to 300 people, I can just use my regular voice.
It's actually the first thing I knew about you, is that your voice carries.
I know. It's a very common phrase I get.